This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, October 23rd, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, two of the National Book Award finalists. Poets reliably make news when A, they're already famous and they die, and B, when they win a big award. In either case, the New York Times might cover it, maybe even reprint a poem. The National Book Award for Poetry will be announced on November 20th, so we thought we'd get ahead of the curve and introduce at least some of the finalists. We've already heard from Matt Rasmussen a few weeks back on this program. He was nominated for his book, Black Aperture. Today in the program, we're going to sample a poem each from two more finalists, Adrienne Matika and Lucy Brock-Broido, from readings they did for the Poetry Magazine podcast. Adrienne Matika was nominated for his book, The Big Smoke. Last year, a few of his poems from another book that's still to come out were published in Poetry Magazine.
When I was a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut, but we were way too poor for such a thing. And I have terrible eyesight, too. I mean, my contacts have contacts.
Matika began writing this new book after a visit to the McDonald Observatory in Texas. The trip reignited his childhood love for the stars, but while he intended to write a book about astronomy, the poems had their own trajectories.
I just kept trying to write about the stars and kept writing about how poor we were.
Every memory of stargazing was also a memory of being broke.
When I was really young, we lived in this neighborhood and the richest person around was the drug dealer. And the first time, I'm positive that I saw the stars before this, but the first time I recall seeing the stars was when he let us hang out at his house playing Atari on his projection screen and forgot to kick us out. And so I heard my mom yelling outside, and I went out, and it was nighttime, and I saw the stars. It must have been 7 or 8.
The poem you're about to hear comes out of another memory of a very special shirt. His reading is followed by a discussion of the poem by Poetry Magazine editors Christian Wyman and Don Scher. Here's Adrienne Matika reading Map to the Stars.
A Schwinn ride away, Eagledale Plaza. Shopping strip of busted walkways, crooked parking spaces nicked like the lines on the sides of somebody's mom-barbered head. Anchored by the Piccadilly Disco, where a shootout was guaranteed every weekend. Those gun claps, coughing stars shot from sideways guns, shiny enough to light the way for anyone willing to keep a head up long enough to see. Not me. I bought the Star Map shirt for 15 cents at the Value Village next to the Piccadilly during the daytime. The shirt was polyester with flyaway collars outlined in the forgotten astronomies of disco. The shirt's washed out points of light, arranged in horse and hero shapes, and I rocked it in places neither horse nor hero hung out. Polyester is made from polyethylene and catches fire easily like wings near a thrift store sun. Polyethylene used in shampoo bottles, gun cases, and those grocery sacks skidding like upended stars across the parking lot. There are more kinds of stars in this universe than salt granules on drive-through fries. Too many stars, lessening and swelling with each pedal pump away from the Value Village as the electric billboard above flashes first one DUI attorney, then another who speaks Spanish, so the sky above is constantly chattering like the biggest disco ball ever.
When I read this, I thought oddly of Seamus Heaney. I think we think of things as being more poetic if you grow up in a pastoral, rural environment, you know, and Heaney was famous for bringing that kind of material into English poetry. And here you've got lines like, there are more kinds of stars in this universe than salt granules on drive-through fries, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
You make that, you bring that constellation right down into your life of, you know, going to the drive-thru
right.
window.
And making poetry out of polyester.
Yeah.
When you hear Map to the Stars, you might think, you know, map to
Beverly Hills.
Like Beverly Hills,
right.
Yeah. Where a map to the stars above, which again sounds so peaceful and lovely, and his ambition to go out into space. And the poem is wonderfully earthbound. I mean, you know,
yeah,
this is like the poet laureate of the strip mall here. Yeah. We've all seen Value Villages, but he is able to string together these little points of his own landscape and invest them with the kind of glittering thing you would expect to find in stars, but he finds them here.
Crooked parking spaces nicked like the lines on the sides of somebody's mom-barbered head.
Yeah, it's really fabulous. And then, you know, of course, the biggest disco ball ever. I mean, just pulling these images from the world around us is something poets always want to do, but this guy's really done it here.
That was Don Scher, the current editor of Poetry Magazine, with Christian Wyman, who was the editor at the time this podcast was made last year. Now to Lucy Brock-Broido, who is the director of poetry at the School of the Arts at Columbia University. Her poem, Extreme Wisteria, is included in Stay Illusion, the book that is a finalist for the National Book Award. The poem first appeared in the December 2012 issue of Poetry Magazine. This was the Q&A issue, where the editors queried the poets about their poems and printed the exchange after the poem. It's really helpful to understand what a poet was going after in a particular poem. Lucy Brock-Broido said on the Poetry Magazine podcast that Extreme Wisteria got its start from something a reviewer, the poet Peter Davison, wrote about one of her books.
He wrote Brock-Broido's single subject was the idea that every single thing she loves will, perhaps tomorrow, die.
That line makes its way into the poem, as well as other details from her life. Brock-Broido said that Extreme Wisteria is really straight autobiography.
With a lot of tilt and irony and self-deprecation in it.
The way her story is told is not at all straight autobiography. She explained that it's a conversation with somebody asking questions and somebody else answering, but the poem doesn't include the questions, just the answers. And the person giving the answers is not the poet.
It's kind of an intake worker at a place I've invented called the Abandonarium. That would be the place where you go when you've been abandoned, jilted, left.
All right, so let's hear the poem of this intake worker describing one of the inmates at the Abandonarium. Then a discussion of the poem by Christian Wyman and Don Scher. Here's Lucy Brock-Broido reading Extreme Wisteria.
On abandon, uncalled for, but called forth. The hydrangea of her crushed each year a little more into the atter of herself. Pallid, injured, wild in ecstasy, a throat to come home to, Tupelo, lemurs in parlors, inconsolable, parlors of burgundy and sleigh, unseverable fear. Wistful, woke most every afternoon in the green rooms of the Abandonarium, beautiful cage, asylum inn. Reckless urges to climb celestial trellises that may or may not have been there. So few wild raspberries, they were countable and triaged out by hand. 10,000 count Egyptian cotton sheets. Intimacy with others, sateen, extreme hyacinth as evidence. Her single subject, the idea that every single thing she loves will, perhaps tomorrow, die. High editorial illusion of control. Early childhood, measles, scarlet fevers, Cleopatra for most masquerades, gold sandals, broken home, convinced Gould's late last recording of the Goldberg variations was put down for her. Unusual coalition of early deaths, early middle deaths as well. Believed, despite all evidence, in afterlife, looked hopelessly for corroborating evidence of such. Wisteria, extreme. There was always the murmur, you remember, about going home.
Well, I was glad to have this helpful little information that these are the answers without the questions. I didn't know that. And I don't think you need to know it, actually, to read the poem. It makes sense, what she says.
Yeah.
Although she also says that it's not her, but in the Q&A, she says quite pointedly she's through with dramatic monologues. Mm. And she actually points to the things in this poem which exist in her house.
Lemurs in parlors, inconsolable.
Well, not the lemurs in parlors.
I was gonna say.
She said she made that part up. But a lot of these other things, she says, do actually exist in her house.
10,000 count Egyptian cotton sheets. Intimacy with others, sateen. Extreme hyacinth as evidence.
I think the part of this that will appeal to most people is really just that sense of all these images creating this strange place, the abandonarium, which is a great idea. I mean, it's the kind of thing that she's invented, but it seems to us that it's always been there.
Mm-hmm.
And there is something extreme. You know, when you look at the poem on the page, the lines kind of torque themselves around the way wisteria does.
Yeah.
It's filled with apt things like that. Even the rhyme of lemurs, since you mentioned them, lemurs and parlors, and murmur and remember at the end. There is a kind of murmuring in the poem. It's a little scary and dreamlike.
Well, there are stunning lines. I mean, just stunning. Reckless urges to climb celestial trellises that may or may not have been there.
Yeah.
And then this.
So few wild raspberries. They were countable and triaged out by hand.
Triaged out by hand. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
We asked her if Dickinson was an influence, and she said very self-deprecatingly that I was with Dickinson, but Dickinson was not with me. Right? And I thought that was... She has very articulate and inventive answers. She says, we inherit whatever canon we're in the midst of, a great collective influenza. Where she combines influence with illness that we that we catch. This poem is not easy, and I think you do have to figure out how to read it, but it does teach you how to read it. It makes you slow down.
Cleopatra for most masquerades, gold sandals, broken home, convinced Gould's late last recording of the Goldberg variations was put down for her. Unusual coalition of early deaths, early middle deaths as well.
But, you know, I think the complaint about a lot of poets is that they are obsessed with death, and that's what Peter Davison was saying. And I do think this is something that 20th century poet, now 21st century poets have had to fight against. It becomes a powerful energy in your work, and then how do you transform that into something else? And I think the triumph of this poem is that, in fact, she manages to mention all of these deaths that presumably she has experienced, early childhood deaths, early deaths of friends. And yet the poem has this almost playful, buoyant delight in its own making, for one thing, but also in existence. You know, it manages to transcend that statement that Davison makes about her.
Christian Wyman, the former editor of Poetry Magazine. Don Scher is the current editor. Lucy Brock-Broido and Adrienne Matika are both finalists for the 2013 National Book Award for Poetry. You can subscribe to this podcast and the Poetry Magazine podcast in the iTunes Store, or you can stream them straight from the Poetry Foundation's website. If you have any comments on this program, email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.